The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 30, 2024. As usual, the border of the front cover is in red with a narrow white inner border. Person of the Year is in capital letters in white on the top of the page, beneath which is Time in large capital block lettering and kind of a blue-gray superimposed upon a gradated blue-gray background. The Person of the Year, Donald Trump, is seated in a portrait on the cover. He's dressed in dark blue suit, white shirt, red tie. His hair is sandy, blondish, gray, and he's looking away from the, well, that is, he's looking above the lens of the camera. Now, this edition of Time is dedicated to what Time calls the something of the year, the person of the year. We'll start with the CEO of the year, and we might end up at the last entry, which will be an icon of the year. So Time, again, this is according to Time. Time CEO of the year 2024 is Lisa Su, and that is SU. The article is by Billy Perigo, Santa Clara, California. And there's Mr. Trump again on the verso. Lisa Su is a female. She's dressed in a pinkish peach outfit. It looks like a suit. Don't know if it's a skirt or pantsuit. And she's leaning against a table or a desk. She has high gray hair combed away or brushed away from her face. She's smiling at the camera with brown eyes behind rimless glasses, and her lipstick is kind of a peachy pink to match her suit, coat, and skirt or slacks. Turning the page to CEO of the Year, Lisa Su apologizes if she seems tired. And again, this is by Billy Perigo in California. It is the day after the U.S. presidential election, and like most of the nation, she was awake till the early hours, transfixed as results came in, only tearing herself away once it became clear Donald Trump had won. I wanted to know, Sue explains as she takes her place at the head of a conference table in the Santa Clara, California headquarters of Advanced Micro Devices, AMD. It is relevant information. The identity of the next president is pertinent news to most of America's CEOs, but few more so than the leader of a top semiconductor company. Semiconductors, or chips, are the engines of our computers, phones, cars, internet services, and increasingly our artificial intelligence, AI, programs. The relentless rise of the chip over the past seven decades has grown economies, transformed lives, helped cement the U.S., where most chips get their start, as the globe's post-war hegemon. AMD is one of the world's leading designers of the CPU chips that power both personal computers and data centers, the vast warehouses of servers that make possible the likes of Google, Meta, Amazon, and Microsoft. It is also a top designer of graphics processing units, or GPUs, the specialized chips used to create and run AI programs like Chat GPT. When you send an email, stream a movie, buy something online, or chat with an AI assistant, chances are an AMD chip is providing some of the computing power needed to make that happen. In November, a supercomputer that runs on AMD chips displaced another AMD-based machine to become the world's most powerful, which is thanks in part to Sue's leadership. When she became CEO a decade ago, AMD stock was languishing around $3. Its share of the data center chip market had fallen so far, executives rounded it down to zero. And the question on everybody's lips was how long the company had left. An engineer by training, Sue spearheaded a bottom-up redesign of AMD's products, repaired relationships with customers, and rode the AI boom to new heights. In 2022, the company's overall value surpassed its historical rival, Intel's, for the first time. AMD stock now trades at around $140, a nearly 50-fold increase since Sue took over. This fall, Harvard Business School began teaching Sue's stewardship of AMD as a case study. It really is one of the great turnaround stories of modern American business history, says Chris Miller, a historian of the semiconductor industry and the author of Chip War. For all its progress, AMD remains the semiconductor industry's distant number two. As Sue's team was speeding past Intel, both companies were lapped by NVIDIA, run by Sue's cousin, Jensen Huang, which in 2 years has risen from industry also ran to become the most valuable company in the world. NVIDIA got a jump on its rivals by realizing its chips, initially made for rendering graphics, happened to be perfectly suited for training neural networks, the programs that underpin modern AI. Of the $32 billion worth of AI data center GPUs sold in the third quarter of 2024, NVIDIA's accounted for some 95%. In November, AMD announced it would lay off 4% of its global workforce in what it framed as a restructuring to focus on the opportunities from AI. Meanwhile, big tech customers like Microsoft, Meta, and Amazon are now designing their own specialized chips for AI workloads, which could reduce their reliance on AMD products. And AMD's continued growth relies on a host of factors outside its control. Continued progress in AI, the security of Taiwan, where the vast majority of its top chips are manufactured, and the actions of notoriously unpredictable U.S. President. Trump's return to the White House will bring new turbulence to an industry that has barely caught its breath from a half decade of geopolitical showdowns, shortages, and an AI-fueled market boom. A lot rides on Sue's ability to steer the company through these obstacles. People who know her describe Sue as a shrewd strategist who invests in talented people and jettisons those who are not pulling their weight. "I don't believe leaders are born. I believe leaders are trained," she tells Time, ahead of a strategy meeting where she delivers blunt feedback to her executives and urges them to move faster and delegate more. Sue, 55, holds meetings on weekends and is known among her executives for wanting to talk on morning calls about the finer points of long documents that were circulated after midnight. When prototype chips get delivered from the factory, She often personally goes down to the lab to help scrutinize them. It's a hard-charging style that is not for everyone and makes it difficult for people who do not meet their commitments to survive at the company, according to Patrick Moorhead, a tech industry analyst and a former AMD executive who left before she joined. The potential for artificial intelligence to transform science, healthcare, and the world of work hinges on access to a diverse supply of chips. In the brewing Cold War between the U.S. and China, semiconductors are among the most vital battlegrounds, and America's economic success, as measured by its stock market at least, depends now more than ever on the continued growth of companies that design, produce, and utilize chips. Ally Seisu is up to the task. "We could not have a better person qualified for this job," says Jerry Sanders, the company's 88-year-old founder and first CEO. "Does she have what it takes to beat NVIDIA one day? Not a question in my mind," he says. In October 2014, Forrest Norrod was sitting in his car at a McDonald's drive-thru when he got a phone call from Sue. Norrod had just quit his job as an executive at Dell, intending to take some time off. Sue wanted to pitch him on joining AMD, where she had just been appointed CEO. While Norrod waited for his quarter pounder with cheese, he listened to her vision for the struggling company. By the next day, he was at AMD's Austin headquarters, weighing the opportunity to lead its server business. Norrod had seen how the pace of innovation in the cloud chip industry had dropped off once AMD had allowed Intel to dominate the market, and believed customers were paying the price. He got a sense Sue was a leader with a rare combination of traits, a technical background, business acumen, and people skills. He accepted the job. Sue was born in Taiwan and moved to the U.S. at age 3 when the family immigrated so her father could attend graduate school. She grew up in New York City and discovered a love of STEM subjects at an early age, growing fascinated by the ability to write rudimentary programs on her Commodore 64 computer. She fondly recalls creating, at the science-focused high school she attended in the Bronx, a project in which she simulated a hurricane inside a box, complete with boiling water and windows through which to watch the maelstrom. She chose to major in electrical engineering at MIT after determining it was the most difficult option and eventually earned her PhD in the subject. It was at MIT that Sue first experienced a semiconductor lab, where she was taken by the idea that such a tiny piece of hardware could carry so much mathematical firepower. She spent the first years of her career at Texas Instruments and IBM, two first-wave tech titans, which taught her about how to run a business and manage teams. "I was really lucky early in my career," she says. "Every 2 years, I did a different thing." She accepted a VP job at AMD in 2012, and by 2014 had ascended to CEO. "I felt like I was in training for the opportunity to do something meaningful in the semiconductor industry," she says, "and AMD was my shot." Sue took over an indebted firm that had fired 25% of its staff, sold and leased back its Austin office, spun off its expensive chip factories. It was a moment of change for the tech industry writ large. Smartphones and tablets were ascendant. Consumer PCs, AMD's main market, were in decline. "It did not look at the time that Lisa was really set up for success," says Stacy Razgon, a chip industry analyst. "She was handed a tough situation." Sue's turnaround plan had three steps: build great products, focus on customer relationships, simplify the business. Some AMD board members wanted to pivot toward making low-power processors for phones. Sue rejected that approach. We needed to bet on what we were good at, she says. What AMD was good at was building powerful processors. Sue set a goal for her engineers to build a new CPU chip that was 40% faster than the previous generations. And she started a team on an even more ambitious project to explore how to develop a chip for the world's first exascale supercomputer, a machine capable of carrying out 1 quintillion operations per second. The decisions revealed a core tenet of Sue's leadership philosophy. People are really motivated by ambitious goals, she says. The previous strategy of, hey, let's just do a little bit better here and there, that is actually less motivational. The problem was Sue's plans would take years to come to fruition. In the meantime, AMD was still on the ropes. My job as a CEO was to give the engineers time to do the work, Sue says. She inked deals with console manufacturers that won AMD the revenue it needed to keep afloat. In 2016, she signed another with a consortium of Chinese companies, licensing some of AMD's designs so they could make processors for the Chinese market. That deal brought in $293 million, though it would later come back to haunt AMD. By 2017, the company was on stronger financial footing, and the new flagship chip was finally ready. Engineers had redesigned the CPU from the ground up, making use of a new architecture, which the company called chiplets. Until then, the chip industry had mainly etched the different parts of a processor into one piece of silicon. AMD's innovation was to put different circuits onto individual pieces of silicon, then fuse them all together, which made manufacturing more reliable and scalable. Engineers suggested to Sue they call the new chip Zen, because it was designed with a balance in mind between energy efficiency and high performance. The name stuck. Meanwhile, Intel, AMD's main competitor, was beginning to flounder. Its new cloud processors were beset by delays. When AMD's chips hit the market, they were the best on the block. With each new generation of Zen, AMD's share of the cloud CPU market grew. Today, its share of that market is 34%. When AMD's overall valuation surpassed Intel's in 2022, it felt fantastic, Norrod said. It's something that I don't think anybody in the industry would have believed was possible just a few years ago. Now, this article is about to be abridged right now. If Sue is right, let's do one more quote. There's no one size fits all in computing, Sue says. The broader the ecosystem, the bigger the party. If Sue is right, the size of the party is going to keep on growing. She predicts the specialized AI chip market alone will grow to be worth $500 billion by 2028, more than the size of the entire semiconductor industry a decade ago. To be the number two company in that market would still make AMD a behemoth. Sure, AMD won't be overtaking NVIDIA anytime soon, but Sue measures her plans in decades. When you invest in a new area, it's a 5 to 10 year arc to really build out all the various pieces, she says. The thing about our business is everything takes time. This very lengthy article was abridged quite a bit. It was entitled Lisa Sue, CEO of the Year 2024, written by Billy Perigo, Santa Clara, California, with additional reporting by Simone Shaw, New York. Okay, next we have Time's Athlete of the Year, 2024. This looks like it could be long and abridgeable also. It's Caitlin, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, Clark. And this is written by Sean Gregory, Indianapolis. Okay, photographed by Cass Bird for Time. It's black on black, hard to describe. A dark-haired woman wearing a black outfit. She has her right hand in the air. It's long-sleeved and black, holding a basketball. Turning the page, few jobs require less physical exertion than rebounding for Caitlin Clark. On an early November morning in downtown Indianapolis, Clark sprints along the three-point line at the Fever practice gym, trying to bang as many shots as possible over a six-minute span. Now, again, this article starts by saying few jobs require less physical exertion than rebounding. For Caitlin Clark. A Fever coach has tasked me with standing under the basket to retrieve the misses. But as Clark, the two-time college national player of the year for University of Iowa, reigning WNBA rookie of the year from Indiana Fever, and emergent American sports icon, runs all over the court to launch long-range bombs, I barely have to move. That was what I expected to be said. Swish, swish, swish. She hits 14 shots in a row, a dozen in a row, 11 in a row, 9 in a row, another 9. Sure, she is putting on this display in practice, but her ability is still mesmerizing. Clark, 22, takes shots with a degree of difficulty never before witnessed in the women's game. Her signature 30-foot launches from near half court on team logos across America are akin to home run balls hanging high in the air. Can she actually make that flabbergasting attempt? Yes, it turns out, over and over again. After her workout, I fill Clark in on the statistics from her shooting session. 93 three-pointers in 6 minutes. Good for an 85% success rate. Wow, she responds, that's pretty good. Nice to know that after wowing so many around the world throughout her record-breaking year, Clark can still impress herself. In February, she set the new NCAA Division I women's basketball scoring record. A few weeks later, she broke Hall of Famer Pete Maravich's mark, making her the top scorer overall. Her college championship game between Iowa and South Carolina averaged 18.9 million viewers, becoming the second most watched women's sporting event outside the Olympic Games in the history of the U.S. television. As a pro, she set a rookie record for most three-pointers made in a season, while also setting all new all-time WNBA marks for most assists in a season and most assists in a single game. She signed a reported $28 million endorsement deal with Nike, the largest ever for a women's basketball player. Clark's Fever appeared in the most watched WNBA games ever on ABC, CBS, ESPN, and ESPN2. The WNBA attracted an all-time record of more than 54 million unique viewers across all its national broadcasting platforms during the regular season, and the league's overall attendance jumped to its highest level in more than two decades. The Fever broke a WNBA record for home attendance by a single franchise, and Fever games were moved to NBA and NHL arenas in Las Vegas, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C., to accommodate the hordes of fans, many donning Clark's number 22 jersey. When asked to define her year in one word, Clark chooses historic. Clark, it quickly becomes clear, is polite and down-to-earth, but also has not an ounce of false humility. I have been able to captivate so many people that have never watched women's sports, let alone women's basketball, and turn them into fans, she says. Good luck naming another player who altered the trajectory of their entire team sport within 5 months on the job. Lionel Messi had a monumental influence on Major League Soccer when he arrived in Miami last year, but he was in year 20 of his pro career. Michael Jordan energized the NBA in the mid-1980s, but Larry Bird and Magic Johnson had already put the league on solid footing. While other female athletes have pushed the limits of human achievement and created their own cultures, Serena Williams, Simone Biles, and the stars of the U.S. women's national soccer team all come to mind, the Clark phenomena is still unprecedented. It is one thing to rally around athletes during global spectacles like an Olympics or a World Cup. It is quite another to turn routine regular season games in the WNBA, a league neglected for far too long over its 27-year history, into appointment viewing. To be clear, Clark had plenty of help. The WNBA was already enjoying positive momentum going into the 2024 season, thanks to MVPs like A'ja Wilson and Breonna Stewart, and some of Clark's fellow rookies like Angel Reese and Cameron Brink brought their own followings. But Clark took the league and the sport to a new level. Even during a period when investment across women's sports is surging, team valuations are on the rise, and fan interest and engagement are at all-time highs, her arrival was transformative. Clark's skyrocketing fame has upended her life at a dizzying rate. She now has an advanced security squad. A fan asked her to sign a sonogram. The Golf Channel covered her appearance at an LPGA pro-am as if she were Tiger Woods in his prime. She's box office, says Atlanta Dream co-owner Renee Montgomery, a former WNBA player. At times, the plot proved unpleasant. All year, Clark found herself party to raging debates, even though she rarely, if ever, did anything to perpetrate them. I tell people I feel like the most controversial person, says Clark, but I am not. It is just because of all the storylines that surround me. I literally try to live and treat everybody in the same exact, respectful, kind way. That her gender played a role in the level of scrutiny is hard to deny. Clark's introductory press conference with the Fever was a harbinger of things to come. A male reporter appeared to make a cringeworthy attempt at flirtation with Clark. He was suspended and prohibited from covering the Fever. As the season progressed, more flashpoints emerged, whether concerning the marketing advantage granted by her race, fouls that players committed against her, or her exclusion from the U.S. Olympic team that spurred her so-called defenders to push racist, misogynistic, anti-LGBTQ narratives, or even threaten WNBA players directly. She calls this toxicity upsetting and gross, but during the season she addressed the discourse mostly when asked about it in courtside interviews or at press conferences, rather than proactively engaging with it. It is not something I can control, and to be honest, I do not see a lot of it, she told The Athletic's Jim Trotter in June. Her extended interview with Time marks the first time she has talked at length about her year. All all of this is really speaking to something much larger than Caitlin Clark, says Teresa Runstetler, a scholar of African American history at American University. It is speaking to our unresolved issues about race, gender, and sexuality in American society at this particularly fraught moment in our political landscape. Still, in the face of all this heaviness, joy remains the resonant vibe of Clark's 2024. Her talent brought together communities to celebrate her fire, unselfish play, and ability to score in inconceivable ways when she needed to. Clark certainly fed off this electricity. "You feel powerful," Clark says. "People are invested in the game. They love the game, and that's what makes it so fun for me. These people are not supporting women's sports to check a box. It is going to be the new normal." The weekend before our interview, Clark attended back-to-back Taylor Swift shows at Lucas Oil Stadium. She met Swift's mother and boyfriend, Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. When fans noticed her sitting in a suite, they turned around to take pictures or toss her friendship bracelets. "People are just going crazy that I'm there," she says. "I thought people would be so in their own world, ready to see Taylor, and it was just completely the opposite." Swift gave Clark 4 bags of Eras Tour merchandise with a note saying Clark was inspiring to watch from afar. She said, "Trav and I were excited to get to a Fever game now that the tour was winding down," and invited Clark to attend a Chiefs game with her. Clark has always seemed destined for greatness, if not friendship, with the biggest pop star in the world. Her path to this women's sports paradigm shift started in West Des Moines, Iowa, where Clark played multiple sports as a kid. She's the second of 3 children. Her father, Brent Clark, is executive vice president at a company that sells and distributes agricultural and industrial parts, and her mother, Ann Nitzi Clark, is a retired marketing executive. Jan Jensen, an Iowa assistant coach at the time, first watched Clark play when she was in middle school. She hit a step-back 3-pointer and threw a long pass her teammate could not catch. But the ball was on the money. "You could see her swag," says Jensen, "the way she walked in a peewee game when everybody's like, 'Your shot hit the rim, let's go get ice cream.' She's like, 'I don't want any freaking ice cream, I want to win.' That is when the Caitlin Clark mission began." Her Catholic family wanted to pick Notre Dame for college, but Clark shunned the Fighting Irish to play for her home state school. She put up big numbers at Iowa immediately, but had trouble hiding her frustrations. She'd shake her head when someone screwed up or take it out on a towel or a chair. The coaching staff worked with Clark to improve her body language, and she reined it in for the most part. By her junior year, Iowa was knocking off undefeated South Carolina in the national semis to reach the finals against LSU. That championship game was Clark's inauguration into the 24-hour sports news cycle. In the final moments, when it was clear LSU would win, Tigers forward Angel Reese approached Clark and pointed at her ring finger. A bit of trash talking that sparked needlessly cruel backlash. Reese was labeled classless and worse. Clark and Reese were pitted against each other as rivals, a narrative that's carried over to the WNBA. "I don't get that at all," says Clark. "We are not best friends by any means, but we are very respectful of one another." Going into her senior year, Clark was in a much different position than women's basketball players who had come before her. Iowa played summer exhibition games in Italy and Croatia, and with the help of name, image, and likeness, NIL, sponsorship money from brands like Nike, Buick, and the Midwestern grocery chain Hy-Vee, Clark treated her teammates to a yacht outing in the Adriatic. "I wouldn't say it was boozy," says former Iowa manager Will McIntyre, now director of scouting and technology for the Rutgers women's team. "I would say bougie." Clark loved college life and even considered returning for a fifth year instead of entering the 2024 WNBA draft. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, NCAA players were granted an extra year of eligibility. Around January, however, Clark knew it was time to move on. It helped that the Fever had won the draft lottery, assuring Clark unquestionably the number one pick would begin her career in the Midwest. She announced her intention to enter the draft at the end of February. Lynn Dunn, then the Fever general manager and now a senior advisor, saw the news on X. "I would have done a back handspring if I wasn't 77 years old," says Dunn. About a month later, on the eve of this year's NCAA tournament, West Virginia's coach told his players, "Let's send Caitlin Clark packing." So after Iowa dispatched the Mountaineers in a second round, Clark stood on the scorer's table and sang "Country Roads" at the top of her lungs. "I kind of just troll," Clark says. Clark is cognizant of the racial underpinnings of her stardom. "I want to say I've earned every single thing, but as a white person, there is privilege," says Clark. "A lot of those players in the league that have been really good have been black players. This league has kind of been built on them. The more we can elevate black women, that's going to be a beautiful thing." When the Fever hosted the Chicago Sky June 1, Indiana gutted out a 71-70 victory. But that game won't be remembered for the basketball. In the third quarter, Chicago's Chenity Carter hip-checked Clark to the floor. Carter was called for a foul, which the next day was upgraded to a flagrant 1 violation. But while the WNBA could revise the ruling, it could not stem the ensuing furor. That Angel Reese jumped off the bench and appeared to cheer Carter only added fuel to another Clark-adjacent fire. Some pundits cited Carter's foul as evidence that jealous players, particularly black players, were targeting Clark. The Chicago Tribune weighed in with an editorial imploring Clark must not be allowed to become a target for rule breakers. The intense commentary came with consequences. Security had to intervene at the Skies Hotel a few days later when a man approached Carter with a camera. "I've been called every racial slur imaginable lately, and my teammates have had it even worse," Sky forward Breonna Turner wrote on X. Obviously, that shouldn't ever happen within a game, but basketball is physical. Your emotions can get the best of you. My emotions have gotten the best of me many times. She says she did not see Reese cheering from the bench. "I don't even know if she really knew what happened," says Clark. "Honestly, I don't think she was cheering because somebody hit me. I really don't think that would be the case. I hope not." Reese's representatives did not make her available for this article. To get to lunch after her workout, I trail Clark down a rainy back alleyway that smells like garbage, past the raised trash service bins, through the kitchen, down a narrow flight of stairs to a private room of a restaurant scouted by her security team. I tell Clark and Fever guard Lexi Hull, who's joined us, the walk reminded me of the famous scene from Goodfellas, where the mafioso, played by Ray Liotta, enters the Copacabana through the kitchen. They have not seen the film, but appreciate the comparison. We are mobsters, says Clark. Over carnitas and fish tacos, we talk about their new head coach, Stephanie White, who'd been hired 3 days earlier. Clark insists she had nothing to do with the change. I'm not the general manager of the team, she says. Believe it or not, says Hall. Her day concludes at historic Hinkle Fieldhouse, where she watches McCaffrey's Butler team win its season opener. Fifth grader Ellie Dillon and a friend, both wearing Clark shirts, wait more than a half hour after the game to catch Clark, who, as she's leaving the gym with McCaffrey, stops to give them autographs. It almost doesn't feel real, says Dillon moments after meeting Clark. That's actually her, standing right in front of you. And this article was also very lengthy and considerably abridged. And the next profile will be Time's Icon of the Year 2024, Elton John, by Belinda Luscombe, New York and London. And there are four photographs of John photographed at his home near London, November 20th. The photographs are by Miles Aldridge for Time. The full-page photo spread, first of all, includes four one-fourth-page photos of Elton John. The background in all of them is a bright red-orange, I don't know, drapery or some kind of a backdrop. Elton John has short hair in each of these photos. He's dressed the same in each photo. His hair is cut short, parted on one side, and combed over to the other side, and it is Lucille Ball bright red carrot hair. He's wearing a bright pink corduroy, it appears, jacket over a black shirt, collarless shirt, which then features on his chest a bright gold heart-shaped pendant. In each of the photos, he wears a different colored pair of square-shaped eyeglasses. One is bright blue, one is bright green. Oh, excuse me, two are bright blue and two are bright green. And now, moving to the article by Belinda Luscombe, New York and London. Okay, this is a long article. We won't finish it all. Elton John has no address. Visitors to his home are given three names, the name of a house, the name of a hill, the name of a town, which is near Windsor, as in Windsor Castle, where King Charles III lives. Admission is granted via a big iron gate that swings silently open to a crunchy driveway. A small turreted gatehouse, a pond with geese, hedgerows, wordless men with wheelbarrows and Wellingtons, and after a little walking, a three-story red brick Georgian compound. From the outside, it has stately but understated air, commonly associated with English gentry. One of the property's chief treasures is a really old oak tree. This is not the Elton John most people know. That guy's loud. The glasses, the outfits, the sexuality, the concerts, the retail expenditure, the platform heels, the temper, the parties, most of all the piano, all set permanently at Fortissimo. John has been in showbiz 60 years, and for 50 of these, he's been a front man, inordinately and excessively famous. His triumphs, mistakes, strengths, weaknesses, wigs, and duck costumes have been in full and permanent plumage. The wealth and passions he became known for have not been those associated with aristocracy. They leaned more toward shopping than Chopin. That was the opening. Now I'm skipping to a page of photographs, one of which shows Elton John with his huge pink wig. He's seated at a piano. He's wearing an earring with a star. He's wearing a jacket in black and silver, and the silver are stars, but the one I want to focus on is a little photograph in black and white. It's taken from kind of the side back view. It's a little boy, a cute little boy. He's wearing a dark colored jacket and shorts that are probably gray. This is a black and white photo. He's smiling. He has a little short haircut, probably brown hair. It's dark. He's sitting at an old looking upright piano. It's Elton John. And his keys are on the keyboard, and he's just little. His gift showed up early. As a tween, he did classes at the Royal Academy of Music, but this is before he was a tween. This little guy, I think, is 5 or 6. Okay, going back then to the main body of the article. But these days, the comparison to an English noble feels weirdly apt. John's married with 2 heirs. His philanthropic work is much admired. Some of his possessions, a selection from his impressive photograph collection, are currently on display at one of London's most highly regarded art institutions, the Victoria and Albert Museum. His library is full of trophies that attest to his prowess. An Emmy and multiple other awards crowded together on a small table with some ancient sculpture fragments. He's literally been knighted. From his garden, the current king's grandmother once remarked, "You get a good view of the British monarchy's ancestral home." John has owned Woodside, as the house is known, for nearly 50 years. But until the pandemic, he didn't spend much time in it. Most of his life was spent in hotel rooms while he toured. Like many nobles, he found laundry an unfamiliar task. It was the most embarrassing thing in my life when I went into drug treatment that I could not work a washing machine, says John, during our first interview, conducted in a New York City hotel room in November, while his husband, David Furnish, lies on the bed and 2 publicists wait in the bathroom. I thought, FCK, here you are, 43 years of age, and you can't work a washing machine. That shows you how you are FCK'd up. More than 3 decades later, at 77, he's doing much more than still standing in front of the top loader. Right now, he's dealing with damage to his right eye, which was previously the good one, that has rendered him almost blind, but you would not know it to meet him. The candle that is Elton John has been inextinguishable, no matter how strong the wind. His 57 U.S. Top 40 hits were mostly released during his wild child youth, but he found a second act in writing songs for animated Disney movies, for which he won 2 Oscars, and a third in writing songs for Broadway musicals, for which he won a Tony. There's a whiff of 4th act about him as he moves into the mashup phase of his career, lending his melodies and some vocals to a new generation of performers. It's been a mere 16 months since he had his last hit single, a collaboration with Britney Spears, who had not recorded music for 5 years. This kind of longevity requires not just prodigious musical dexterity and phenomenal luck, but stamina. Few can keep up with fame's sugar daddy demands for long enough to get to the settling down phase with their sanity, health, friends, and family intact. When you're famous, there's like a court around you, says John. People are vying for position, and the nearer you are to me, the more people will get jealous. He has bested or evaded the 4 horsemen that cut down his generation's boldest names: drug addiction, AIDS, irrelevance, suicide. Apart from Paul McCartney, who had a top 10 single with the resurrected Beatles song in 2023, very few of John's contemporaries are still alive, let alone releasing new hits. The Rolling Stones still tour, but their last number one was 40 years ago. John has also survived deep family dysfunction, tabloid fabrication, early hair loss, bulimia, and in the 80s, a brief marriage to a woman. And here's the key part, he has remained prolific. Having performed 4,500-something concerts over half a century, he retired from touring at the end of 2023, but not from cultural output. Elton John, Never Too Late, the most recent documentary on his life, which compares his meteoric first 5 years of touring the U.S. with the final tour that ended in July last year, is now on Disney Plus. He has written the music for and co-produced two new musicals, Tammy Faye and The Devil Wears Prada. An auction of some of his many belongings in February brought in more than $20 million, twice the pre-sale estimate. He has a podcast radio show, Rocket Hour, which promotes young musicians. This year, the 52-year-old song, Rocket Man, hit 1 billion streams on Spotify, while Cold Heart, a 2021 track with Dua Lipa, drew 1 million listeners a day. When Elton and David called me about the collaboration, for me it was because of our friendship, says Lipa. And of course, singing alongside one of my musical heroes was a no-brainer. His music has been able to soundtrack my life from the very beginning. John's outrageous string of hits is now a list of global standards. Do you know how many requests I get a day for the use of our songs on things like America's Got Talent, The Voice, or the silly show where they dress up as poodles? Says Bernie Taupin, John's longtime writing partner, who's provided the lyrics to most of his hits. I don't think Bob Dylan gets a lot of requests for The Masked Singer. In person, the glam rock superstar is gentle, a little shy, eager to please, especially eager to make people laugh. While some frailties are apparent, he still has plenty of bounce. He favors comfy designer tracksuits and sneakers. He doesn't hear too well or walk with confidence. Corrective surgery a few years back made the glasses a mostly cosmetic choice, but a recent eye infection damaged the optic nerve in his right eye, and it is taking a while to heal. His husband is determined to be optimistic about it. I just think it is going to take time, right? Furnish says. It is the evening after opening night of Tammy Faye, the $22 million Broadway musical about televangelist Tammy Faye Baker, who came to embrace and be embraced by the gay community. John wrote the music. The reviews are out. They're dismal. It will be just one day before the show's impending closure is announced. John's mostly philosophical. It is a shame for everyone who put so much work in it, he says, but that's what happens when you take a chance. He and Furnish chalk the failure up to the mood after the election of Donald Trump. It is a fairly political piece of work, he says, and with that, you have to press somebody's buttons. The buttons we pressed last night with the critics were not the right ones. If John seems sanguine, it is perhaps because he's long been more interested in exploring what's next than stewing about his failures. His best-selling 2019 memoir, Me, and Furnish's 1995 documentary about him, Tantrums and Tiaras, reveal a willingness to let people see the less fabulous side of Elton John. It was a bit like video therapy in a way, says Furnish. It gave me a chance to go in with a camera, like a shield, and kind of confront and shine a light on things in his life that I thought were odd. The documentary, which George Michael advised him to bury, captures him in full meltdown mode, insisting on one occasion that he will never make another music video because someone left a bag in a car, and on another instructing his private plane to leave the south of France as soon as possible and never return because a woman waved at him during a tennis lesson. They stay. John still struggles with patience. David can tell you my fuse is very short, and the worst thing about my temper is that David is very rational about things, and he will explain, says John, and I'll get even madder about it. When John met Furnish in 1993 at a dinner party a friend had organized at Woodside at John's request, Furnish was impressed with the star's warmth and lack of ego. But as they grew closer, he realized John, who had endured childhood under a distant and eventually absent father and an ill-tempered mother, was a people-pleaser with self-esteem issues. He was very, very shut down in terms of accepting love, says Furnish. No one had ever asked him to do personal things, like go for a walk together, those kind of joyful things. John was one of the earliest celebrities to come out in 1976, initially saying he was bisexual, when such an admission was deeply hazardous career-wise. After 31 years together, John and Furnish, who formerly worked in advertising, take their gay icon status very seriously. They formed a civil partnership in December 2005, within weeks of its becoming legal to do so, and were married on the same day, 9 years later, after the UK's same-sex marriage laws were passed. One more photo description, and then we're done with this lengthy article, which has been abridged. It's a young, reddish-haired, smiling, eyeglassed young man in a black tuxedo with a black shirt holding a statuette. It's Elton John, who won the first of two Oscars for the Lion King song, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, in 1994. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.